large surgeries.
Woo!
You guys are going to have so much fun with this. It's going to be awesome. We will be implanting the electrode into the antenna of the cockroach. And you guys will have a lot of fun. Dr. Jones just left my notebook where I had all of these notes in for these announcements I was going to make. Dr. Jones.
Yeah.
There was one more announcement I was going to make. Intro. Quiz.
Intro methods.
Yeah, the intro methods. Oh, you have an assignment posted, right? We need you guys to get your draft together. So please look over the details of the assignment that is up. Bring your questions to your lab section, and we'll be able to work with you one-on-one and get some group discussion going on so everybody is on the same page for writing these drafts. Please do your best work on these drafts, because the more work you put into it on this end, the less work there's going to be when you go to write your entire paper, and you will love yourself. You will look back at this draft, and you will say, oh my gosh, self, thank you. Thank you for doing a good job, okay? Yeah? Any questions about that? Yes?
So both the lab report and the draft?
The due dates are up for the lab reports, right?
Yeah, the lab report is due, I think, the day before, or the day of your lab.
8 a.m., I think?
Yeah, I think it's, either just before your lab, depending on what time your lab is.
And I think that one's called Lab 1.1,
yeah.
Correct?
And so that, you can just upload the, there's a file called Lab Questions, mm-hmm. And so you can just upload the questions if you want to do it that way. That's probably the best way to do it. Make sure that you put your name and the name of your lab partners on there. So if your answers are almost the same, we're not like, oh my gosh, you plagiarized. It's more like, oh, they're working in the same group. Of course their answers are about the same.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Yeah, it is under, well, it's under modules. So if you look on Canvas under modules, there's a lab 1.1 questions.
And then we just fill that in.
And it's the same questions from the lab packet. It's just all the other stuff is taken out.
Yeah. Please don't try to customize the documents. We want everybody's document to look the same. Okay? And all of your stuff that you do will be under the assignments that they're listed instead of under files, because there's so many moving parts with this course. Okay.
In the graphs that we're supposed to include, how do we upload those?
You can embed them into the... at the end of that questions file, just embed it there, and that'll be fine. Cut and paste, whatever.
Yeah. You might have to look at that, though. Okay, any other questions? Excellent.
Great.
Dr. Cooper.
Hi. Some of you I know, some of you I don't know. Some of you probably avoid all my classes after this lecture anyways. But what I've done for you is built a web page.
So there's a web page there that you can find. Just look under Cooper, UKY, and you'll find it. And you can click on that. And it's going to go to here. And there's actually a little web page. And what you're going to find there's PowerPoints already posted. And the PDF version's probably wrong. But anyways, you'll get your PowerPoint there. I'll double-check, make sure it's right. And then I have a podcast going in Echo 360. So Echo 360 will be posted, and a podcast will be posted on this website. Okay, so you can, in case you missed something. So I don't want you to have to scribble everything down, you see. And you can hit highlights of it, and then, but just pay attention to what we're talking about. You can, if you miss something, you can go back and look it up, right? So it's kind of an easy way to do it. So this will be posted there with the podcast and the Echo 360 right there. All right. And so what we want to talk about today is electrophysiology and synaptic transmission, and to have some fun with it and to try to understand where the field has come from and where it's going and what on earth do people do with electrophysiology. Any idea besides these people that are in our neurophys course that we have? So we do teach a course. It's called, what is it, number?
446.
Yeah, 446. It's a neurophysiology techniques course. After you have this class, it'd be really good, then that class will help you get into some more depth. So it's your building as we go along. You can ask these two, Christina and Maddie, that are in that class at the end of the semester, if they still recommend that. Oh, and Jeffrey's right here, too. Right. So I remember your names. It's very good. And they can tell you to avoid it, or that it's okay. But, So really, some of the first understandings of bioelectricity is with this work, early work that you might have heard of before in your high school anatomy physiology textbook or whatever class you're taking with Galvani back in the 1700s. And you're going to be probably recording with backyard brains, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
And are you doing the EMG recording, the muscle recording?
Not in this lab, no.
Okay. Okay, so this is really kind of fun, too. You can put two electrodes. We do this with high school and elementary school and middle school students for outreaching projects. It's really kind of fun. If anybody wants to help out and volunteer with these outreaching projects, we do demonstrations. You're welcome just to email me, and I'll put you on the list, and you can make that time if you can. That's great. So you can put two electrodes on your bicep, for example, and a little ground wire, and you can contract your arm, and you'll actually pick up the electrical noise. You can record it on your iPhone or iPad. And it's really fun for the high school, middle school students because then they can record that and play it back and show the parents they actually learned something in school today. But the idea is that you can record this field potential with surface electrodes, and it gives you an idea of what's going on with your muscle. Any other kind of examples with that that you can think of where you record with surface electrodes and understand what's going on in your body?
Isn't it used for robots to find the area?
Yeah, you could use it actually if you were doing a Botox-like injection and you find out if that muscle's still working. I mean, they do, if you're ever in, like, rotating in a surgery or something like that, and you see somebody under anesthetic, the anesthetist, you know, anesthetist, right, or anesthesiologist, if you're looking for good jobs, look at nurse anesthetists, too. They walk out of nurse anesthetist 90K right away, and there's a big demand for it. So go to nursing school, 4 years, right, get out, go 2 years, master's program, nurse anesthetist, you're walking out the door with 90K. No big investment in money, and you can have to go anywhere in the country pretty much. But anyways, they put this across the forehead, and it'll actually be stimulating, a little bit of stimulation, and the muscles will contract. But when they see what they don't contract anymore, guess what? Too much anesthetic. So they back off a little bit. So they keep doing that, and that's a really nice practical application. I was thinking of something else, though, too. EEG, right? Electroencephalogram. R and E. KG or ECG, right? K, cardio, germ, C, cardio, English. Okay, so an E, and the why I make that, because some people in like three animal physiology, if you can take that on an exam, you said, I thought it was an EKG, no, I thought it was an ECG. Confusing. It's the same. Okay. So anyways, so you can record an EKG, right, with two electrodes across here and maybe one on the rib, or do multiple leads, and you can get an idea of how the heart is working. And it is a very powerful technique because you can really find out the contraction frequency. You can actually even find out by the mean electrical axis how your heart is situated in your body. So like a pregnant mother, if it rises, it actually changes the mean electrical axis that you can pick up with EKG. You can pick up if you have a potassium imbalance, for example. It's amazing. Lots of neat things that you can do with like surface electrodes without getting invasive in the body. But anyway, the beginning of bioelectricity, to understand that you were having electricity generated in your body, that's pretty amazing, right? So people used to think before this time that it was kind of magical, right? They didn't really understand it. They thought it was like spirits. I mean, really, it was bizarre, right? That was actually flowing through your body to even have muscle contraction. They thought that your muscles, when you contract, like the bicep gets bigger, they thought that it filled up with gas. You know, kind of weird, right? Experiment. So when they cut that open and no, gas isn't leaking out, right? And you can stimulate it when the, like a dead frog and still get the muscle to contract with the legs off. So a lot of weird things in the history if you look back. But Galvani was really quite interesting, and he had read Benjamin Franklin's work with the key and the electricity and the kite, right? Lightning hits it and has electricity, so he thought, this is kind of interesting. He actually went out on an electrical storm night in Italy and set up this apparatus so he could hope that electricity would hit this rod and actually shock his preparation, because if he could get electricity to flow through there, he thought he could get his muscles to work. And he actually did these kind of neat experiments. Probably dangerous, too, at the time. And there's a lot of kind of mystery around some of this and some folklore as well. But anyways, this is kind of his setup to get electrical current when, like a lightning rod would hit it and make his little frog jump, for example, his frog muscle. So it's really kind of interesting. This guy, Volta, and you probably remember in your physics class, galvanic current, Galvani, right? This is where it comes from, volts. You know, if you measure volts in your electrical signals, this is Volta. that worked this out. Now, Volte could speak English really well, and Galvani was Italian, and from Padova, one of the oldest universities in Europe, actually. And he didn't explain things very well in English, so actually Volte carried on his work and presented it to the University of London at the physiology meetings, one of the first organizations of scientific input, and he got a lot of credit, but he kind of didn't give all the credit to Galvani. But Volte then followed up on a lot of this work back in the late 1700s, and he actually used another way that's kind of neat. He used static electricity. So you've ever, you know, rubbed a balloon against the wall, right, and it sticks to the wall. So because of static electricity, well, he generated static electricity, and he could put that together with a wire and get electrical shocks. So he developed that approach to actually shock nerves that then could make the muscle move. Fortunately, today, we don't have to do that in the lab, right? We have stimulators that you can just tweak and turn it on and do those kind of things. But think of those experiments where you had to generate static electricity to do your experiment. I mean, amazing, right? It's all easy now today. No excuses. Okay, so some interesting history there with bioelectricity. And there's a book out, you know, on Galvani and Volte and their work, so you can really go into a lot more if you want. Nowadays, you can just do a Wikipedia and find out a whole bunch of stuff, right? So let's see if this thing will work. I bought a new one here. So some of the work that they did early on was something really interesting. They used two dissimilar metals, and this was really quite interesting to explain that electricity traveled down a nerve, and it wasn't gas or some magical potion or something. That they could get this muscle, touch one against this nerve, this motor nerve, and the other one on the muscle, and damage the muscle a little bit so the ions would flow and actually stimulate this nerve. When they touch those two metals together, just like static electricity, when you touch something, you get shocked, right? So that would shock and then make the nerve contract, which then would release transmitters, make the muscle contract. That would move ions, and then they could pick this up from this crushed muscle, stimulate this nerve, and then this one, you know, would then contract too. So they knew it was electricity that was happening. So this is some of the early work in understanding bioelectricity and that nerves conducted electricity. Okay, so way back in the 1700s. So where do we go today, right? Well, there was actually a big dead time and from these earlier experiments, and this is kind of where people were, just looking at nerves and these kind of experiments, and they really didn't go into more detail. Why do you think they couldn't really get into more detail about ion flow and maybe understanding how synaptic transmission works? Why do you think it didn't advance faster? Any ideas? Yes?
Yeah, probably because it was on such a microscopic scale that it had the ability to do experiments.
Exactly. Limitations of technology, really. Right? They didn't have a lot of the amplifiers. It wasn't that long ago. It was only late 1950s where intracellular recordings were first developed, where you could actually stick an electrode into a cell, in a living cell, small cell, and actually record the membrane potentials. So limits on technology. So this is a big breakthrough for science in general. Something new technically comes, and then you could really advance, like imaging in our brain, right? Phenomenal what's going on today. I don't know if you ever get Science Daily. How many people get Science Daily besides people that are in my animal phys class that had that before? Science Daily, if you want to get Science Daily. Science Daily, right? It's cool, isn't it cool? So in case you're not logged on, go to Science Daily, log on, and get an email every morning. So when you're in bed and you're getting that stress of getting your legs out of bed, you can at least hit your iPhone and read Science Daily and find out new things that are happening. So this last year, and then you're all pepped up to go to classes, and you just can't wait to ask Dr. Jones and Sean Hurd about what's going on in neuroscience today, right? Well, one thing that came out just this last year is they found something like 30 new places in the brain that they never knew that existed before. When they look at activity patterns when you're doing a task, so they actually came up with new classifications. And why? New technology, right? In no way could they really see how a circuit's working before until they could get into the imaging. When you're doing a motor task or a mathematical problem or you're thinking of something. And now they can tell pretty well if you're lying about something when they do these images or if that's, you know, you're trying to deceive somebody. So you never know where this might go later on, right, with this kind of technology. So it's kind of interesting to think about. And so those limitations. So it really took a long time before they could develop better techniques. And one preparation came along that was really useful for people, and that's the squid. You know, if you ever had squid to eat or something, right? Go to a restaurant, Chinese restaurant, for example, order squid next time you go there, just so you have squid, so you can say you ate a squid. But anyways, the squid is this, you know, long animal, and they could take out this giant axon. And the axon is the size of your pinky, basically. I mean, in diameter. And it's actually the length of the animal's mantle that goes down there. And it's so big, you can take that out, and with your pencil, and you can actually roll it like toothpaste, the back of it, and squish out the cytoplasm. Isn't that wild? Initially, when they first looked at it and did methylene blue staining on the squid prep, when they were dissecting it out and just classifying it, they thought it was a tendon. It was so big. They didn't know it was a nerve. And then they started to find out that was a nerve. So they could actually squish out the cytoplasm, and now you have this empty tube, and guess what you could do with that? You could tie off one end, and you could put solutions inside, and a wire on the inside, and tie off the other end, and put the whole thing into a bath of what? Just seawater. And that was kind of serendipity. A lot of things are by serendipity in science, by accident, right? I mean, many things were by accident and made many discoveries. So it was kind of serendipitously worked out that seawater, just the ocean water, was very similar to the extracellular solution, extracellular fluid in the squid, because they are ocean animals to begin with, right? But it wasn't that far removed. So they could take that squid axon, put that electrode in, change the solution on the inside, whatever they wanted, put that thing into the saline, and then put a wire on the outside and had a wire on the inside. They could give a little shock and see what happens. And if they have some other wires down on the other side, they could actually record the electrical signal. They could record an action potential that travels down the nerve. Wow, now we can understand how nerves work, right? We could understand action potentials, and not only that, we could understand what happens when you change the concentration of the solutions on the inside or the outside. So when you think about excitable cells, I made this joke in another class. I was on an airplane one time, and I was reading this book. It's about membrane biophysics, ion channels. And so there's a whole field out there that just studied ion channels, how ion channels work, like sodium channels, calcium channels, potassium channels. They're called biophysicists, and they're usually physics backgrounds. And they study how ion channels work. It might sound boring, but you think about it, it's a very important field. So some very famous little book is out there called Excitable Membranes. I was on an airplane one time reading this for a graduate class in ion channels, and I'm reading this, and the gal next to me was saying, oh, I bet that's an interesting book, because, you know, excitable membranes on the surface of it. And I showed her, well, not really, it's all mathematical equations. And So excitable membranes. Why is a membrane excitable? Why are cells excitable? How can you have an excitable cell? What would make your heart excitable? What makes your nerves excitable? What makes your muscles excitable? Any idea? How can you have an excitable cell? What makes a cell excitable? Is your skin? Pardon? That's right. Somebody says depolarization. Some depolarization? Yes, back there, sorry. Depolarization. What causes that depolarization? Pardon? A membrane potential. How do you get that membrane potential? Difference in concentration of ions, right? And sodium potassium ATPase is very important. So ion difference, but just that you have an ion difference can set up a membrane potential. But what do you have to do to excite that cell? You got to have the ions that move, right? So they have to move. When you take a plus charge, like a sodium plus one or calcium plus two, and you take it from here, from point A to point B, what happens? You move to a charged ion, right? So now you have an electrical difference, right? You have a potential difference. When you move the charged ion, that makes an electrical difference, right? So if we can open up channels in this membrane and allow ions to move across, then we can have an excitable cell. But you also then have to have what? A gradient for that to happen, right? For ions to move. Now, when we talk about gradients, we might just first think right off the bat, a concentration gradient. But it's not just a concentration gradient. It's called the electrochemical gradient. And this is really important to remember. It's both the electrical gradient as well as the concentration gradient that determines which way an ion is going to move. All right? And we'll see that that's important. So this is just an example. You shouldn't try to memorize numbers. because it varies from cell to cell. It varies in your own body, from a muscle cell to a liver cell to a kidney cell to your neurons, and not all neurons have the same concentration of ions actually inside the cell. And they all have different membrane potentials. So you can measure your heart cell, your pacemaker cell, it has a different resting membrane potential. On your heart itself, you can measure in the ventricle, it has a different resting membrane potential. So not all cells have the same membrane potential. Why is that? Because different distributions of ions, different densities of ion channels, and maybe they're more permeable to one ion than another, and that changes the membrane potential. And we'll see how that comes about. But there's some things that we should remember. What's generally higher outside the cell than inside the cell?
Sodium.
Sodium is high on the outside. Another ion is high on the outside. You can cheat. Look up here.
Chloride, right?
Chloride. And another ion.
Calcium.
So calcium is also high on the outside. And how to kind of remember this that you'll never forget in case you're taking standardized exams or examine here. Think about when you're sweating, right? You're jogging, you're sweating, you're late to class, you're running here with fast food. It's hot, hard, like we're sweating right now in here. And the sweat runs down, you taste it. What does it taste like?
Salt.
That's your table salt, right? What's in table salt? Sodium chloride. So think of external sodium chloride. That might be an easy way to remember, higher on the outside. And then just remember that calcium is also high on the outside compared to inside. And this really varies. It could be 10 to the minus 6 inside some cells, right? It depends on the cell that we're talking about. So in general, sodium's high outside, potassium is high on the inside, chloride's high on the outside, and calcium's high on the outside. So potassium's higher on the inside of cells. And like you mentioned, rightly, if we had channels that opened up and allowed sodium to go in and calcium to go in and maybe chloride to go in, how does it reset itself? How does it get back to its normal concentration gradients?
Sodium,
potassium, ATP. It's the pump. And probably in you right now, the most energetically demanding process in you is probably maintaining ion gradients up and actually through the sodium-potassium pump. Think about it. You're sitting here. Your eye has a million neurons in the back of one eye, right? And all this activity is going on. Are your brain thinking about it? Are your heart working? Are your muscles moving? Those are ions going across there. And you're not really exercising, right? So it's not like ATPase for muscle contraction working, but it's just that ion flow and how you get it back to normal so you can be active again is with your sodium potassium pump. And so that's a very energy demanding process to make urine, actually, to absorb food across your GI tract. It's all driven by the sodium potassium pump setting up a gradient. So if we have that gradient and maintaining that with the sodium potassium pump, that's ATP dependent. Now, just sometimes a misconception on exams, you see, where does that ATP come from? Not outside, it's inside the cell. So what do we see in highly active cells? Mitochondria, right? Mitochondria inside the cell. Okay, so let's look at this for a second, and this kind of helps put it in perspective too. It doesn't matter if we're talking about a squid in ocean water or a frog or you, for example. You can see the concentrations vary, like a squid, a seawater animal, very high, you know, sodium and chloride outside the cell over here. Very high, right? Very high. But low on the inside, higher with potassium on the inside, just like we mentioned, and low on the outside. If you look at the frog, amphibian, also sodium's high on the outside and so is chloride, but much lower than the seawater animal. The point here is the ratios are very similar in the sense of high for those ions. It doesn't matter if you're like a seawater animal or an amphibian or a mammal compared to other ions. So the ratio is very similar, these high ions. So early on, let's go back to the squid exon. They were lucky that the squid sodium on the outside in a normal animal is very much like seawater. And they could take their squid exon and put it in seawater. And that's how they did their early experiments. And so it was really quite neat to understand how this worked for electrical activity. So just that we're talking about ion movement, a little bit about ion movement. Can a charged ion, like a sodium ion, just go right through a bilipid membrane? Remember your bilipid membrane? No, not really, right? But it's a charged ion. It wants to go in. It's higher on the outside. And we're going to talk about the electrical gradient later, which also drives it into the cell. But it just can't go right through the bilipid membrane, right? It has to go through a protein, a channel. a channel. So some things can diffuse across the membrane. Anybody remember what could diffuse across the membrane? Bilipid membrane?
Triglycerides.
Possibly triglycerides are going to be lipophilic that get into the membrane. It might not just want to go into the other into the cell. It's a good point though. If it's lipid soluble, right, then it wants to get into the membrane. Oils could do that, right? Any other ideas? Pardon? Some people think that water might be able to go there, especially if you kind of break down the membrane, but mostly water goes through the channels as well. Okay. And then you might see some exceptions, but in general. How about non-polar substances, right? Because this is a polar bilipid, right? Polar head groups, phosphate groups, long carbon chain tails, and then on the other side, phospholipids, phospho groups here, charged, carbon chains here, so we have a hydrophobic region and a hydrophilic region, right, on the two outsides because of charge. So, what could go across there? If that's charged, how about a maybe non-charged substance? How about like a gas? CO2 can go right across. Nitrogen can go across, right? So CO2 can go across, and that's kind of neat too because CO2, if a cell is metabolizing a byproduct, CO2, it can go out of the cell, right? That's one approach as well. So some things can diffuse across the cell without transport or without the ion channel. But what we've been talking about are some of these channels. And these channels, there's different properties of these channels. Some of them are what we refer to generally called leak channels. So leak channel just means they're leaky, right? And they're open, and they're not really voltage dependent. They just allow ions to flow across. It's kind of weird, right? But this is kind of a group that they refer to as like leak channels. And then we have other transport mechanisms like a carrier-mediated transport. Like, let's say, sodium and glucose could be a co-transporter. It needs both sodium and glucose combined to a protein, and then sodium and glucose can go across the cell, for example. That's what happens in your GI tract. All right? And then you have other types of ion channels that might be either a co-transport, I mean, not transport, but two ions going across, or there could be even an antiporter. But you could have channels that are voltage-gated. That means this is a protein. What is a protein made out of? Amino acids, right? Amino acids, you have amino acids that have charge, right? You have neutral amino acids. It depends on the pH. But let's say you have a protein that's folded around, going across this membrane, and it has some negative charges, and maybe some positive charges on it, right? And if you had a potential difference across this membrane, let's say an electrical action potential is coming down across this membrane, that amino acids can sense that voltage change, and what's that going to do to their, are they going to stay still? If you have a negative charge here, and then all of a sudden a positive charge comes by, what's going to happen? It's going to be attracted to it, right? But if it was another negative charge, what's going to happen to that negative charge? It's going to be repelled, right? So it's the same idea with those amino acids that are charged. They're going to change their conformation based on the electrical field that they sense, and they can then open up. And this is what happens in you, like with your voltage-gated sodium channels. A potential change across that membrane causes that those channels all of a sudden to sense it, and they change their conformation. So a key element in biology is, if you don't know an answer to a question, if you ever in doubt, just say conformational change. Right? Conformational change. The answer for lots of things. Conformational change. All right, so you have a conformational change, and then that can open up a channel, and you can get ions to move across. And then, like we talked about, a sodium potassium pump. Yes? Non-polar lipids?
Like steroid hormones.
Yeah, steroids can go across and go right inside. And people have thought, like a disome, testosterone, estrogen, they can go right across into the cell. People used to think that that's their main target of action, which is to go across and bind to a cytoplasmic receptor, and then it could actually change gene, turning on a gene, for example. They now know that there are receptors on the surface of the cells, even for like testosterone and estrogen. So you could have a cell surface receptor as well as a cytoplasmic receptor. Right? So steroid molecules perfectly.
Okay, so
kind of get the idea of transport, ion movements, all that kind of good stuff. All right. So we can pass through this stuff. So what makes an ion channel selective?
Let me just check this. It's because
I just had to double check that because my mom has had some hospitalization recently. Gallstones, very bad. Oh, I can really drive you crazy. She's 90 years old, just a sidestep. This is my continuous side tangents. But think about it. If you had your gallbladder out, can you still get gallstones? She had her gallbladder out 30 years ago. She's 90 now. Feisty as ever. But you can still get gallstones. I was like, she was like in real pain, and she was, and then started getting sick. And my wife was at home, and you know, she was sick in the morning a little bit. She thought it was just some bad food. And then my wife was trying to reach me, and I was in a meeting, actually at a master's thesis. And I'm getting these texts keep going, and I'm trying to turn it off, and then I see ASAP, and I'm like, oh, we've gone. Okay, I'll just go to the bathroom and figure it out, and then answer the phone. And that's what you do if you're in class. You just go to the bathroom, and you can answer the phone. Sorry, I didn't hear that. And then my wife says, you better get home. Your mom is just kind of like shaking and stuff. So I go home. I bike like a maniac because I run my bike. And then I got home, and she's like really in pain. I said, okay, so you're kind of shaking and stuff. What's happening? I'm thinking potassium imbalance. Something's going on ionically or something. So she had diarrhea. And then I think, okay, let's get her to the ER. So we go to the ER. Central Baptist is right close to us. Go to the ER, and they push right here, and it's really painful. And it's probably a gallstone. I said, well, she had a gallbladder about 30 years ago. Doesn't matter. It's even people don't even ask that really anymore. It's not a something to worry about because that duct can still have gallstones. And she had a gallstone in there, backed up. She started getting jaundice, kind of. They took it out. And 90 years old is bad for having pancreatic enzymes in your blood, starts chewing up your muscle and everything else. So she's recovering. But anyways, that wasn't the whole matter. That was the blood center because I donate blood, and they're like vampires. When your 100 days are over, they call you again right away. So, anyways, we're talking about ion channels. So when we're on the ion channel, what makes it selective? Let's think about this. How is this selective to sodium? Doesn't have calcium do it through? Or potassium? How can an ion channel be selective? You know, isn't that wire? It needs to get these ions through. Some of it by size, but look, you know, like sodium, potassium, not that much different, you know. So if a potassium ion is bigger, then why doesn't sodium go through the potassium channel? We got, calcium's not on here, but calcium's pretty big too. And if calcium is big ion, then how come sodium and potassium just doesn't rush through a calcium channel and push away the calcium, basically. The sodium's even higher in concentration than the calcium. Isn't that wild to think about? And this is what those people in membrane biophysicists do all day long, right? They think about these things. And so it's not just the size of the ions, but that's one contributing factor. So when you take your test that you might get later on, this is one of those kind of questions that you might get. What makes ion channels selective for ions? One, the size of the molecule might be a factor. But another factor is the hydration sphere. Think, these are charged, right? These are charged ions. So what's going to be attracted to it? Which goes back to this question over here about water going through the membrane. Water molecules around here are attracted to this positive charge. And the number of water molecules that can fit around this is what we call a hydration sphere. That hydration sphere is actually bigger for some ions and smaller for others. And that contributes to how well they can go through the channel. Now, some people, those membrane biophysicists are really smart people, they actually wonder, does the whole ion go through with the water? Or does the water get stripped off of that ion? Well, if you strip the water off, that's a van der Waals force, right? Van der Waals forces, remember that? That you've heard in chemistry? Yeah. It all comes back to you. And so that van der Waals force, what's going to happen if you pull that water away? That takes energy, right? So that means it's some force to strip that water molecule off. And that's kind of interesting, too. So they've actually calculated how much it would take to strip water molecules off an ion. Can you believe that? That's crazy, isn't it? Van der Waals forces, and then how well that ion can go through that channel. And that's some of the limitations as well. What else here? We see plus, plus, plus. Where's the chlorine? We don't have chlorine. What else could make selective permeability for an ion through the channel. Hint, we just kind of hit
charge.
The charge, right? So if we had a chloride minus and a plus, and remember the protein, the ion channel, is made of what? Amino acids, right? And amino acids have what?
Charges.
So if you had positive charges on the inside of that channel, the pore part, positive charges, what's going to be attracted? A negative. And what's going to be repelled? A positive, right? So let's think about this. And membrane biophysicists think about this too. So this is really kind of neat to think about when you start going deeper and deeper and deeper. So let's say we had a positive charges on the inside. And this chloride is just going to love to come in here, right? So it comes in here, it goes into the ion channel. How does it get out? If it likes to be around those positive charges, the chloride ion likes to be around those positive charges, how do you get it out the other end? How do you get it into the cell? Yeah, maybe boom, 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 like dominoes, right? So that's some of the ideas that people think about. It's really wild. Lots of wild ideas out there. But that concentration gradient helps drive it in there, as well as, and this is a selectivity filter to select the different types of ions. And even the mouth, the pore of the channel, can have charges and attract, like calcium ions or sodium ions, to the pore. So the concentration gradient can be a little bit different right at the pore of a channel than just out in the back. Right? Because of the charge of the amino acids. So I know this is a little bit crazy, a little bit in depth, but begin to think about, there's a lot to this, right? A lot to ion channels. All right. Then we have the other type of kind of channel that you can think of, and these are gap junctions, where these are really interesting for in your nervous system. You have a part in your brain that has a few gap junctions. Anybody? Do we talk about that anymore in textbooks? I don't know if they do. No?
Not
really. I don't think it's that much. There's one little spot in your brain. It's called superior olive. People are kind of really wondering what it does. But it's there. And there's actually gap junctions there. But that whole little unit, people are still trying to figure out what that region of the brain does. But for some reason, there's gap junctions among those neurons. You have more gap junctions like in your smooth muscle, in your GI tract, and in your heart for electrical conduction, right? In your heart. These are channels made by subunits that come together. And these are so amazing, because what happens here? They're made in this cell, and there's subunits that come together in this cell. And then this cell makes subunits, and they have to line up just right to then make a channel between the two cells. That is pretty neat. So there's a whole field in this idea about finding channels with gap junctions. Where do you see gap junctions in the animal kingdom, pretty much? In the nervous system? Where would you think?
Possibly.
Well, what's the purpose of these gap junctions? I mean, what's so different about these than, say, other ways to communicate from cell to cell? So this cell maybe gets electrically excited. What can this do? Quickly excite the other cell, right? And we're going to talk about in a little bit the other form of communication called synaptic transmission by chemicals. So right now this is electrical transmission, right, from this cell to the other cell. So this is relatively fast, right? If we have to release a chemical from this cell, it has to diffuse, hit the other cell, maybe open up an ion channel or something, and then get an effect. That's a little slower process, right? So where do you think that you might see this in the animal kingdom, and what kind of behaviors do you think that might be associated with?
Maybe an adrenal response, like fear or something?
Yeah,
like
some kind of fast escape response, right?
Reflexes.
Reflexes,
like
some kind of reflexes.
That are sprouted through your spinal cord pain. Improvement in response to pain and that kind of thing.
And so we don't have that kind of like mammals, but other animals, you're right on. Other animals could do that very quickly to maybe escape from a response. And I love this example. Little crayfish. You're going to love crayfish. We kept talking, you all want a crayfish, don't you? But crayfish, for example, the tail of the crayfish. You ever touch the tail of the crayfish? No? We should have brought some in, sorry. Next time. Maybe we can give it to y'all and you can play with it in the lab. So you touch your crayfish tail. What does it do? It tail flips. You touch it in the front of its nose, it'll tail flip backwards, right? Escape. But if you touch it on the tail, it tail flips very quickly. It might not even see what's hitting it on the tail, right? But it wants away because it thinks it's a big fish. It's about to eat it, right? So an escape response. So if we look at a crayfish circuit, and this is why it's kind of interesting to think about crayfish. This is another reason why I like PowerPoints, because my drawings are pathetic. But anyway. All right, so let's look at a crayfish tail in segments. the other crayfish on the back tail. If you whack this crayfish right here on the tail, the tail flip. All right, so we have sensory nerves, and the cell bodies are out here in the periphery and have a little sensory ending. We activate that sensory nerve. It goes to the sixth abdominal ganglion, and it synapses onto interneurons. Okay? Interneuron is communicating from one neuron to another. This interneuron travels around, let's just say, and it activates, it goes up this ventral nerve cord, and it can actually activate multiple ganglion up the nerve cord. But inside of this ganglion, let's draw an enlargement, it has sensory endings that go on to dendrites of another cell, and this cell is a motor neuron. I'll write it MN. It releases chemicals that then activate the, This is an interneuron, okay? And this interneuron can go up the cord, but there's also a motor neuron here, MN, that can go right out to this segment, these muscles in this segment, okay? So there's multiple synapses. Some synapses from the sensory nerve onto an interneuron are actually right onto a motor neuron, or this interneuron can actually have synapses on this motor neuron as well, okay? And the motor neuron then goes to the muscles in that segment that then causes its tail flip. So when you touch on the tail, boom, tail flips very fast. Well, here we have synaptic communication. And here, from the interneuron to the motor neuron, these are gap junctions. Okay, so gap junctions, just like those. So now what we have is a little delay from the sensory neurons to the interneurons, or maybe even to the motor neuron. But if we go to the interneuron, and then we have a gap junction, very fast electrical communication, right? And then you get the tail flip. Why am I even wasting any time talking about that? Besides, crayfish are so cool. This response you can do with cutting the abdomen off the crayfish, right? Just have it in your hand, you can pinch the abdomen, and it will tail flip like that, right? So that's kind of neat. Well, Don Kennedy worked this out by recording from sensory neurons here, interneurons, and motor neurons, and in the muscle, and worked out every part of that circuit, that neural circuit. That was the first neural circuit ever described to characterize a whole behavior. It became so well recognized in the 1970s, he became president of Stanford University for like 10 years. Wow. That's how big the news was, to work out a whole neural circuit, neuron to neuron, and understand the synaptic communications as they go through, and to then relate that to the behavior. But also, gap junctions here, very fast communication, right, for that tail flip. But what happens if you keep hitting the tail? Keep hitting the tail. What do you think is going to happen if we keep doing this? This nice behavior, maybe we can talk your instructors into doing this sometime. You can take a crayfish and keep hitting the tail. Tail flip, tail flip, tail flip, tail flip, tail flip, tail flip. Keep hitting it, and no more tail flips. Why did it stop tail flip? Any ideas? Besides the same people. Pamela? Yes?
Is it kind of like a sensory adaptation?
Yes, something like that. And we call that as a term habituation, right? So that's very good. So it's an adaptation. And remember, sometimes we use these words interchangeably, and that's, you know, that's used correctly, adapted somehow. And in biology, sometimes when we say adaptation, what do we mean? We mean over lifespans, genetic modifications, right? But we also use that term as adapting, like adapting very quickly, and like this kind of condition is adapting. So don't get confused. Sometimes it depends on the class you're in. If you're in a genetics class, they're probably, and Dr. Jones can correct me, if you're in a genetics class, the adaptation is genetic, you know, like evolutionary processes, right, that are going on. So it does adapt. It habituates. So how does it habituate? You habituate to the noise, and this, let's say the air fan's going on, you hear it, you know, when you first come in, but then you habituate. It's like listening to me over the hour, you're going to habituate. But you don't pay attention to it anymore, right? So you kind of phase it out. That's higher cognitive process, right? You're maybe thinking about it, or you're not thinking about it. Maybe you don't pay attention to it, but if somebody's whispering over there, then you kind of pay attention to it, maybe they're talking about it, something. So, you know, it depends on how you perceive that and what you want to focus on. But then how does this tail habituate, and you could cut it off the, from the crayfish higher centers with tail flip. Wait a little bit. I'll be gonna go get a coffee, come back, hit it, and then it starts to tail flip again. What on earth is going on, right? So this is what people were interested in. And why the crayfish model? Because you can look at it from the synaptic level. You can look at it from the sensory neuron to the interneuron to the motor neuron to the muscle. Where does this habituation occur in a model organism where you can address it at a synaptic level? So people did this. So Don Kennedy's students still today work on this circuit from the 1970s all the way to today, right? Still going on. And you can probably hit PubMed and look at crayfish tail response, and you're going to find papers that were probably published this last year. Still going on. Because why? It's such an interesting component. And they realized that the habituation, the sensory neuron fires the same every time. You hit the tail, it's still firing. You record from the sensory neuron, it still fires every time you touch it. But the response can die down. And it's in the synaptic responses to the inner neuron where the habituation occurs. Isn't that wild? That's wild, right? How does it happen? So this is what people study. Why is this happening? To understand that neural circuit so you can understand our processes. So here's something that's wild. And an undergraduate did this in our lab, and because it was kind of an unknown phenomenon what was going on for a good while, but people have described it before too, is that you can take a lobster. They hate me at Kroger because I always go to Kroger and take the lobsters. And they say, do you want to buy one? I say, no, I just want to look at it. And you tap on the glass. Sometimes you can actually, they'll let you play with it, like put the net inside and do things to them. And mostly they don't like it. And so, and you can actually hit them in the nose and they'll tail flip, you know, backwards and things like that. You can tell how healthy they are, so you know which ones to buy. You can buy them, make sure they really respond really well. So the claws on the lobster, you know, are pretty big, right? And the same with the crayfish, if you've seen those. And they'll raise those up. And if you look at the adult crayfish, so let's look at the adult crayfish, big chelopeds, right? They have big chelopeds. And you put a small crayfish next to it. What's going to happen? And let's say there's lights out there. It's not cave crayfish or something, right? It's with light. And the little one comes up to the big one. What's going to happen? Is the little one going to attack it like a little chihuahua, crazy chihuahua dog? No. The big one just has to raise its chelopeds up. And the little one says, back to it, right? So it's going to get away from that very quickly, a visual response. Those big kick-like claws are something else. And the little one just backs away. It's just a visual response. If you touch the big crayfish, a really big one on the back of the tail, it might tail flip once. And then it's going to turn around, as people that have worked with crayfish in the lab, or will be working with them, it'll turn around and say, yeah, you want to mess with me? Yeah, come on. You know, with those claws, right? And it wants to fight you. All right? So that's what happens. And the little one just backs away. So this is a social way. And you think about it ecologically, it actually saves energy, right? Why fight if you're going to lose? Because they are cannibalistic. They will tear each other apart to work out a social hierarchy. One's going to become dinner if they don't back down. I probably never will get to this lecture because of my tangents. But anyway, that's why they put me away in other courses. But anyway, The problem with the little guy, the little crayfish, you can keep touching them on the tail, and they like to tail flip all the time. They really don't habituate very quickly. It takes them a longer time to habituate. So why is it in age of this neural circuit you get a difference in habituation? Just age, right? Young crayfish tail flip for a long time. We have a student in the lab, maybe you know him, Samuel Wyckoff. He actually looks at habituation and touches a tail, and he's looking at habituation rate in these animals with different kinds of, well, don't want to give it away yet, I'll tell you what's happening. But, so the little guys keep tail flipping for a long time, but you look at the big ones and they'll just do it one or two times. So age dependence of this neural circuit changes. What does it do to? What's happening in these synapses? Right? This is what people are interested in. So, it was known in the late 70s that if you take the big crayfish or the lobster and you pinch on their chelopeds, they have just like a lizard. You know, you pick up a lizard by the tail, what happens? It's gone, right? And you can't keep it for your herpetology experiment. And so because it breaks off at a particular spot, it regrows its tail again. Well, all lobsters, crabs, and crayfish have an autotomy plane also in their leg. So if you ever go to the Red Lobster and you have a little claw, they're getting chipped, right? They get a regenerate leg. They'll regenerate their leg back again. So you can pinch on their legs, and they'll donate it to science so you can do your experiments. So you pinch there, the autotomy plane, it'll grow back. So if you take a big crayfish with those big claws, doesn't like the tail, put the little crayfish next to it. It just raises its gill, heads up, and the little one runs away. But all you have to do is just pinch on their legs, the claws come off, and now the little crayfish comes up to it, and guess what the big one does? It's scared, and it goes away. And you touch it on the tail, and it starts to tail flip. What happened? You just pinched on its claws, and it starts to tail flip. And it's the same circuit. So it means it's not really hardwired so much that it could be modulated that quickly, right? That's pretty amazing, right? Something that could be amazing. So actually, an undergraduate lab, and he just now finished med school, but he was actually interested in this, in the crayfish, and he actually was a third year medical student that could take some rotations, and he actually came back to the lab to finish his paper, so it was kind of interesting. Marie Page. He wanted to know if this was a neural component that would go to the higher system in the brain, the head of the crayfish, right? Okay, we'll have the crayfish. The head of the crayfish, it would come back down the neural cord and say, I lost my claws, and now I'm going to change the circuit somehow. So he wanted to know if that was a neural communication, or maybe hemolymph through modulators, like a sympathetic response, like epinephrine in us. But in the crustacean world, we're talking about serotonin and octopamine and dopamine and things like that. So he actually cut this nerve cord in the animal right there, and the bigger animals still don't like the tail flip. And then he went ahead and removed the claws and found out it would start to tail flip with that cut. So he proved it wasn't a descending neural circuit. Right? And you could inject serotonin into the hemolymph of the crayfish. It's an open circulatory system. And guess what the big animals start to do when you touch them on the tail? Tail flip. Pretty cool, right? So it modulates, serotonin modulates how these circuits work and the synaptic responses. And actually it can heighten the responses, like epinephrine in you. It can actually heighten the sensitivity of these responses. So you get the same sensory stimuli, but it actually changes how it responds in that neural circuit. That's pretty cool, right? So you think about animal behavior, neural circuits, it all goes down to synapses, communication, and actually how that synapse works to give behaviors. Not just the architecture, down at the synaptic level, and how you can modify that synaptic level.
Okay. Is it 8 o'clock yet? Is it
4:30 halfway.
Oh, good God. Okay.
Two more hours. Okay. So if you inject like a dye in cells like your intestine, smooth muscle, for example, you can actually see that dye go through the gap junctions and go on down. And why is this so interesting? Dyes, gap junctions. Why do you think this would be of any interest to people in science? It's like Mount Everest, it's just there, you gotta do it, right? Or is there some real interest?
Could you stain something that you suspect is going through a gap junction, and then you could trace it if it fluoresces?
Exactly. And so that's of interest to find out if they're there and how to do that, right? Why might you be interested in how gap junctions work? Because we only have a few in our brain, right? As I mentioned, the superior olive, you probably live without it, you probably go cut it out, wouldn't affect you maybe. So where else do you have gap junctions? We talked about smooth muscle, right? GI, contractions, peristalsis, you don't want everything backing up, right? It's a big problem, right? So you want to keep that GI healthy and the tract working, and peristalsis is how that works. Actually, you expand in that smooth muscle, you stretch it out with a bolus of food coming in, and that actually activates, stretch activation, and that actually causes the continual response to propagate that on down, right? But also gap junctions in what? Heart, right? Cardiac issues, right? If we understand how gap junctions work or have defects, you know, a lot of cardiac problems. So I bring this up in the sense there's a whole field of people that are interested in ion pathologies, abnormal function of ion channels, right? Those membrane biophysicists again, crazy, right? They just study these things. But why do they study that? Because if the ion channel is not working right, like a calcium channel, your heart's not going to work right, right? If your sodium channel doesn't work right, your nervous system's not going to work right. Potassium channels aren't made right, they don't work right. And so your electrical system's off, right? Your nervous system. There's a group down in Nashville and Georgia and another place, where they're actually working together and trying to find out when there's a spontaneous abortion, for example, and they know it might be the fetus develops so far, and then maybe it stops developing, and then they have to go in and actually cut it out because it's dead, right? And they got to remove it, or it can absorb, really. And when you start to think about this, too, and I know it's a sensitive issue, and it's in the politics and all that, but just face kind of the facts about this. When people have done testing on people that are pregnant, right, pregnant with two little blue signs or whatever it is nowadays, right, very stressful time of your life, that you can find those blue signs, and you know you're pregnant, and you're pregnant, you got it, right? You're not partly pregnant, you're pregnant. And so they actually have monitored this, studies out, that about over 50%, I think it's 53%, of people that are pregnant actually have spontaneous abortions, and about 53% of pregnancies do not go to term. So when you start to think about fertilization and how sacred some things might be, then why is it naturally we have greater than 50% spontaneous abortions in humans? All right? So just file that away for thinking about spontaneously. Okay, so why do you spontaneously abort? Think about a calcium channel that doesn't work right. Is the nervous system going to work right?
No.
Is your heart going to work right?
No.
Is it going to develop correctly?
No.
So as you're developing and your heart doesn't develop correctly, do you think the fetus is going to survive throughout all this? If the nervous system doesn't develop right, will the fetus develop correctly? No. And so then it could stop in development, or maybe an abnormal development, right? And so then it aborts. So this is how important ion channels are. You think about them, some of them aren't so bad. Some of you might have a problem called night blindness. It's a calcium channel mutation. So the calcium channel is not working right. And it's okay, but in the nighttime, you can't function very well. In the daytime, it's okay, kind of. But other kind of channel problems, heart problems, long QT syndromes, for example, in our heart that doesn't work right. You've probably heard of this. More people are understanding that. It seems to be a sodium channel mutation. So when you exercise, it might be more of a problem, right? And you can't function right. So think about this. Every channel is made of proteins. And what are the proteins made of? Amino acids. And how do the amino acids get together in that protein? It comes from what? Go back to your cell biology, right? RNA, right? And where's the RNA read from?
Ribosomes.
And where's all it coming from?
DNA,
right? Right? So DNA, Thomas Hunt Morgan, right? Fruit flies, DNA, genetics. So if you had a genetic mutation, it could be in your genes, but it could be, genetically inherited. It could be just a random mutation. It could be something where your genes are just right. Your DNA is just right. But the post-translational modification, after that protein's made and then modifying before it gets inserted in the membrane, there's something wrong with that. So the gene might be right. The post-translational modification could be wrong. And that protein doesn't get into the channel right, into the membrane right, and then you have an abnormal channel. Lots of things to think about, right? And so people are beginning to understand more and more about that. So this group down in Vandy with Atlanta and Georgia hospitals, they're actually trying to find out about why these spontaneous abortions occur and see if they can collect it from mothers that allow them to go in and remove the fetus that have died inside of them, basically, so they can then do the genetic testing and find out what might be the reason behind it, right? So if they want to have another child. There's lots of interest in this, so you might be thinking about that too, but who's going to study those channels with the amino acid sequence after you sequence those? The membrane biophysicist. They actually can make these channels and inject into, or the RNA for it, and inject it into a frog oocyte, and then have that channel expressed in a frog oocyte, an egg, and then they can put electrodes in it and understand how that channel works or how it's not working compared to normal channels. So they can study the defect that goes on. Right? So that's kind of cool when you think about all this. Right? So why this is really interesting, because we can understand more about the heart. But where did a lot of this work come from? In understanding dye diffusion and the size of that gap junction. You could actually put in different size fluorescent dyes or molecules and find out, how big is that gap junction? And it doesn't allow that big a kilodalton substance to go through. So now we know that it can only transport ions and maybe some very small proteins or a few amino acids through there, but it can't allow big things to go through, right? So now you understand the limitations of the gap junctions. Guess where a lot of this work came from? You need that tattoo. Crayfish and lobsters. And actually, Ed Kravitz, he was a person at NIH that worked at NIH, and a very famous neurobiologist called Stephen Kuffler recruited him to Harvard. Stephen Kuffler was the chair of Harvard Neurobiology, and he recruited Ed Kravitz to his lab to work there. What's interesting, remember when I told you about these gap junctions right here in the circuit? Guess what Ed Kravitz did? He injected, because he could take the lobster, venture nerve port out, and this interneuron's very large, he injected dyes, different kinds of dyes, into this different size molecules, and he then checked to see if it went across the gap junction. So a lot that we understand about gap junctions today, the size, and how big those molecules, and if it's charged or not, came from experiments on your crustacean model in lobsters and crayfish, ventral nerve port. Wild, isn't it? So we have to, you know, come to the crayfish and the lobster gods. All right. Oh my goodness. Okay.
All right, quit. All right. So
that's kind of neat to think about. All right, so let's just go through some general neurobiology, and we'll get to synapses, and probably never get through this whole lecture. So the standard neuron, right? Standard neurons, we all see these neurons, right? Big old cell body, dendrites up there, and then an axon, and then it goes to the nerve terminal, right? And then maybe that's another muscle, maybe that's a muscle or another neuron that's communicating to. And this general anatomy should know, right? It should just be common knowledge for you as you go through this class. And then up there, there's synapses on top of that cell and on those dendrites. And we get in this misconception here. This actually is very confusing many times to students, and they confuse it when they take animal phys, for example. And then they miss questions and stuff. Now, this general idea right here cites spike initiation. Anybody remember those animal physiology students? What's happening here at site of spike initiation that's so different from the rest of the neuron? Where the action potential is initiated, but what's there that allows that to happen? That's right, voltage-gated sodium channels. There's a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels. So as we depolarize, as we'll talk about, depolarize the membrane, goes to this region, those channels, which are voltage-sensitive, sense that depolarization, and boom, a whole bunch of them open up, and then sodium rushes in, produces an action potential, and it travels down the axon. So we call that the site of spike initiation. And generally, everybody thinks it's always after the cell body, and that's where all site spike initiation occurs. Okay, so let's touch your skin. Right, sensory endings, right? Sensory endings in your skin. How do we sense that when you touch your skin? You don't even have to look at it, you're touching your skin, right? How is that mechanical information transferred to an electrical signal? Yes, stretch activated ions. So think of my finger as a sensory ending. It's like the shiny. So the sensory ending right here in the skin. So the skin's across here. As we push on the skin, what are we doing? We're pushing on that sensory ending. And if that has a bilipid membrane, both sides around there, and there's a channel in there, protein, that's a stretch activated channel. But it's closed when it's at rest. But if you deform that sensory ending, those channels open up and allow sodium to go in, for example, in this particular example, and then that depolarizes the cell. And so you touch your skin, you have to open up stretch activated ion channels in your skin, in your sensory ending. Graded response. Now, where's the cell body for that sensory nerve? Where's the cell body for that sensory nerve? Is it outside? In the spinal cord? For sure. Mysterious, doesn't have a cell body, or does have a cell body, I'm still trying to think about it. Doesn't have a cell body? Yes. And it is in the dorsal root ganglion, which is outside the spinal cord, right outside your vertebrae, these cells that sit over here. So now, think about it. We've got a little sodium to come in through these stretch-activated ion channels. Is that little graded response going to travel all the way up that axon, and then your cell body is up there in dorsal root ganglion, and then generate an action potential, and then go into your spinal cord? Too far, right? That little graded response would decrement. It would never make it, right? So you generate your action potential close to the sensory ending, okay? So think about this cell body moving way down here, okay? and your situs back initiation closer to the sensory endings, like these dendrites. Just think of these dendrites like sensory endings embedded in your skin. Okay, so this misconception sometimes happens that we always think the action potential occurs after the cell body, but just think of your sensory neurons, and it's different. It's right by the sensory ending, pretty much, right, to make that action potential so it can travel. So sometimes textbooks confuse me. But in general, then we think about this transmission, and how does, let's say it goes to another, to a muscle cell, or we can think up there, nerve to nerve, right? How does this communication occur? And that's what we'll chit-chat about a little bit. But you're going to be working with this wonderful animal, the cockroach. Cockroach is something else besides being a nasty little beast, but they've really worked with it quite a bit. And look at that. It's kind of similar to that other wonderful animal, the crayfish, not quite as much. But we have sensory endings going into this last abdominal ganglion, sixth abdominal ganglion, going to work on an inner neuron that then can travel up the ventral nerve cord through connectives and go to ganglion. And inside of here, it could communicate to the motor neurons and cause the muscle in these regions, or maybe in the first thoracic, this last thoracic ganglion, the first one it reaches, activate a motor neuron that then goes to the muscles and then allows that muscle to, you know, contract that leg. So if you ever take cockroaches, I know guys probably will do this, but they won't admit it. You take a cockroach, tie a little string around its head, and pop the head off, right? So now you have a headless cockroach. Anybody ever watch Mighty Python? Is that a generation gap? Mighty Python? Anybody know about Mighty Python? If you want something to do in the weekend, go watch Mighty Python shows. And relax you a little bit. Okay. There's a reason to this. It's like this guy gets all chopped off. His like arms are chopped off. There's this little stump there. He says, come on, let's fight. Let's fight. You know. And so it's kind of like the same thing. They take the cockroach. You can actually take a string and pop its head off. And guess what? Then you have a headless cockroach. But go to try to step on it, and you'll have a hard time stepping on it. Because why? It has these reflexes or these circuits in the ventral nerve cord that make it very hard to catch it. And that's why you can't really catch them. You've got to get them in the corner. And then if you're from Texas, you'll be wearing cowboy boots, right? You get them in the corner, and then you can get them because you have the pointed cowboy boots. That's about the only way to kill a cockroach. Okay, so what happens, these little hairs here can detect the wind vibration. They're very sensitive to the wind vibration. They can detect that the wind's coming from this side, and there's a synaptic delay just of milliseconds. I mean milliseconds. And it can tell that the wind first came from here versus there. And that tells the cockroach that these synapses are activated before these. And so when it activates the ventral, this motor neuron, these muscles work to make the cockroach go the opposite direction. That's really amazing, right? It's pretty amazing that they can do that. So how could you trick a cockroach? You can try to get a wind puff and then have something that would go in front of it the opposite direction from the wind puff. That's the same way to catch crayfish, for example. You begin to try to vibrate the water, but you put your net in front because it's going to tail up right inside the net. So anyways, the idea here is that people have used the cockroach for a long time to understand neural circuits, too. For over 10 years, Sivagaigi Sandoz had neurophysiologists that just used the cockroach to understand his neural circuit. Now, why would they be interested in this, do you think? Why would the pharmaceutical company like Sandoz, Hoffman, LaRoche, Sivagaigi be interested in, those are some of the three gigantic, multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical companies. But guess what else they produce?
Are they bored and have too much money?
Yeah, they're bored and have too much money. They also produce insecticides. So if any of you are farmers, look at your insecticides that you get. You buy them in big 50-gallon drums, for example, on your fields. They might have come from Sandoz. And they were interested in insecticides. But what happens every year, basically in the U.S. too, with kids and people that work on farms sometimes, they die of insecticide poisoning. Bad news, right? What do you spray in your house when you're spraying that chemical all over your dishes and you have cockroaches in your apartment? Insecticide. Bad stuff. It works in the insect just as well as it works in you, and it blocks the same kind of responses. So people were interested, like Sandoz and Sivagaigi, if they can make compounds that were more selective to the cockroach or insect's neural system, then there might not be so many deaths in humans that occur from insecticide poisoning. So they looked at this, and it was kind of interesting because they thought, you know, like what anybody would think about, they understood in the research over the time that the frog neuromuscular junction in mammals release what transmitter at the neuromuscular junction? At your neuromuscular junction, what's your transmitter? Acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is released at your neuromuscular junction. This is something that you'll learn through the course. And so people assumed it's also in the crustacean system. I mean, in the insect system. So let's think of a synapse real fast here. If we had acetylcholine here, and this vesicle, this is a nerve terminal, this is a muscle fiber, and the vesicle fuses and releases acetylcholine, it binds to receptors here, right? And these receptors are interesting. These are ion channels. So these receptors that bind acetylcholine are ion channels themselves. They open up when acetylcholine comes on. And it allows sodium to go in and some potassium to come out. That's pretty cool. And it depolarizes. If you had an electrode right there, you can monitor a depolarization in the muscle fiber. So it depolarizes, excites it. What makes it not stay excited? Why doesn't it just stay that way? Because the acetylcholine is out here. What makes it come back down? That's a good point. Maybe the acetylcholine is taken back up. And it's this you actually have a transporter that can transport the acetylcholine, but it's a little bit, let's just think of that as an idea right now.
Deactivated by an enzyme?
Inactivated by an enzyme, so it's chewed up maybe, so it's not there anymore. So enzymes, and we'll just write it as acetylcholine esterase, ACE, so it was an enzyme. Okay, any other ideas?
Hyperpolarization.
Maybe hyperpolarization of what? Of the nerve or the muscle or?
Oh, sorry, I'm thinking about the wrong thing.
That's okay. But you're kind of on the idea. So even if an enzyme's going to take a while, and even the transporter's going to take a little while, right? But so why does it go up and come down if we were monitoring right there? There's something very unusual that goes on. And it happens at your neuromuscular junctions. When acetylcholine is released, it hits these receptors, opens them up. Remember, this is just a protein, right? The protein opens up, changes, conformational change, key answer to everything. Conformational change, sodium goes in, potassium comes out. But after it opens, it continues to move. Just think of that protein continuing to move. And it goes into an inactive state, basically a desensitized state. It goes into a desensitized state. So even though acetylcholine is around, it cannot be back opened again. It goes into a desensitized state. And this is what happens here. This is actually a desensitized state. So it's kind of interesting, desensitized. Now, if we block this transporter, it really doesn't change the shape that much of this response right away. So they know now it's really desensitizing these receptors. They desensitize, and as they desensitize, the binding affinity for acetylcholine decreases. So now acetylcholine will come off. And then what happens? Enzymes break it up into two different molecules. One molecule is taken back up into the nerve terminal and then repackaged inside the vesicle. There's another way to repackage it back inside the vesicle. So this enzyme is really important, too, to get rid of acetylcholine so you don't have rebinding. Otherwise, you're going to rebind all the time, right, after the desensitization goes away. But the acetylcholine has to come off before that receptor can go back to a state to be reactivated again. So the enzyme is very important here to get rid of it in time. But to decrease it right away is actually a desensitized state. And this happens at your neuromuscular junctions. So how do many insecticides work, as well as nerve gas agents? And you have to worry about this because why? What's down the road south of here? Anybody live down in Richmond area? What's down in Richmond area? That's really something you should think about. Bluegrass Army Depot. Right? One of the U.S. stockpile of nerve gas agents. And they hired somebody, Battelle, from Ohio to get rid of it. Multi-million-dollar extermination of basically these nerve gas agents. When the World Trade Center thing happened, there was National Guard down at that Bluegrass Army Depot because they were really worried about that being attacked. And if that was attacked or those chemicals were stolen, because people all know what's down there, it would be really bad news. And they actually have demonstrations here in Lexington with the healthcare workers. Because if there is something that goes wrong, how can they deal with it?
Richmond can't deal with it. They're all going to come to Lexington, and they're all going to go to the ER, right? And they're all going to have nerve gas agent problems. How can they deal with it? So they actually do these kind of drills to have to deal with hundreds of people all at once that would have nerve gas poisoning. But they hired Patel to get rid of this. One idea that people, crazy people had, not Patel, but other crazies, they actually thought, we'll just put it down in the cave system. There's a cave system over there. We can just pump it in. Because these big 50-gallon drums that they have there are beginning to rust and leak. Bad news. And so they have to get rid of this stuff. And so what are they going to do? They developed a way, and Patel has come up with a patent, because they're already doing this across the country. The U.S. is doing this to try to get rid of these things. They came in with a patent to incinerate at very high heat levels, to put the whole drum inside this burning chamber, like a bomb collimator that you might have had in chemistry, and they're going to incinerate it, real high temperature, and inactivate it all. And then the gas goes downstream somewhere. Don't be south of Bowling, of Richmond when they do this stuff. But anyway, it's better than putting it in the water, right? Much better. And some ideas that people have is just to bleach it and actually then diluted put in the water. But, you know, our cave system in Kentucky goes down, Somerset water supplies, bad news. Anyway, so nerve gas agents block this enzyme, many of them, acetylcholinesterases, and your stuff that you spray around the house to kill insects. So what happens if we block this enzyme? What's going to happen to the synapse?
I feel like too much.
Mm-hmm. And so if we have too much acetylcholine here, what did we say happens to these receptors after they bind acetylcholine?
Desensitize.
And we can't get rid of acetylcholine now because the enzyme's blocked. So it stays there. But they're desensitized, so they're not activated. So there's kind of a misconception that you might think, oh, I'm going to be contracted, I'm going to stay contracted. No. Initially, you might be. All your muscles start contracting, right? Because you have a little bit too much acetylcholine. But then all those receptors desensitize, so what happens? No more activation, so you just become flaccid. You don't have any real contraction. You activate the nerve, it's not going to do anything. It might release more acetylcholine, that just makes it worse, right? So now you can't do it. So what did the Army used to give the soldiers to try to block this response? Because they think, oh, nerve gas agents are released, I better do something to protect myself. They give them atropine. And atropine is an antagonist to the acetylcholine receptors. So atropine will competitively antagonize the acetylcholine receptors. So now acetylcholine will come off, and then it removes desensitization, and then you can have activity again. Because if you can't activate your respiratory muscles, you die of respiratory failure pretty quickly, right? Your diaphragm, that's all acetylcholine working in your intercostal muscles. So what happens? So let's say the soldier thinks, I got a nerve gas agent, something came, I see the smoke, you know, maybe it was just a smoke grenade, but I think it's nerve gas agent, so boom, put the atropine in. You just now blocked all your acetylcholine receptors, right? Because it's competitive antagonist. Now you die from the atropine shot. So they kind of got away from that because they don't think it's really good. There's too many accidents with this. And they're trying to get stats about how many people have died from this, but people are working on it. Anyways, there was a neuroscience meeting where somebody was trying to present stuff, the mistakes that are happening in the Army with some atropine injections that they used to give too much. So this is a problem with this, that it stays active. So the idea here, too, of my tangent was that the neuromuscular junction at the cockroach, when they were working out this, they were working on insecticides. And they could cut this nerve and stimulate it with a suction electrode, stimulate that nerve and record in the muscle fiber. And then add insecticides, and they were trying to figure this out. Or maybe atropine and classify these acetylcholine receptors. But they would do it, and it would still get synaptic responses. They thought, oh, this is crazy. What's going on? But how about when we put it on the cockroach dies. It doesn't move anymore. It's kind of paralyzed. So they were kind of at a mystery. Later, they found out, the cockroach neuromuscular junction doesn't use acetylcholine. It uses glutamate. So insecticides don't have any role at the neuromuscular junction in the insects. Where they do have an action, the sensory nerves that go into the spinal, the ventral nerve cord, are acetylcholine. So most all sensory neurons in the invertebrate use acetylcholine as a transmitter. So they were overactivating and then desensitizing the sensory nerves, and the animal couldn't function right. Plus, there's interneurons that use acetylcholine as well.
So this work by Siva Gagne, Hoffman LaRoche, and all that, they put out lots of publications on this, on the pharmacology, and actually they found out that it really wasn't that much different from humans. And they still haven't developed a better insecticide to be just targeted to those acetylcholine receptors. So we still have the chemicals that work on cockroach, that work on you, right? So these are things that we have to be careful about when you're playing with insecticides. All right, so there's a lot of background that has been learned to help us by just in these simple invertebrate preparations. So it's pretty neat. Okay, so let's just think about sensory ending, activates some sensory cell, that sensory cell then communicates maybe to a central neuron, maybe an interneuron, right? That interneuron then might go to a motor neuron, and that motor neuron onto a muscle, right? So we have synaptic communication. How does this electrical signal travel? What gives these cells excitability? And that's what we want to understand a little bit about. So we talked about the squid axon, where people could put intracellular electrodes inside, right? Through the wire, it's like just put a wire in, because it's so big, like a pencil, you put a wire on the outside, and then change the fluid on the inside, change the fluid in the bath, and understand what ions give rise to the electrical signals. It wasn't until really the 1950s, late 50s, that people understood an intracellular electrode, or developed an intracellular electrode. It was actually a group up in Chicago, University of Chicago, where they actually developed a glass micropipette. And we fill it with KCl, 3 molar potassium chloride, a very good electrolyte, put a silver wire in here, put another wire in the bath, and now we measure potential difference between these two wires. So it's just a differential amplifier. Measure the difference between these two wires. But as soon as you stab this electrode into the cell, what happens? So zero at first, no potential difference, stab it into the cell, and bang, you get some negative potential. You get the membrane potential across that cell. Now, last year when we had this class, we had a smaller group, like 11, and we went to the lab and actually stabbed the cells, and you can see that on the oscilloscope yourself. It's too big to do right now. So we can't do that. But what we do have for you is demonstrations. So you can pass this around. Don't stab yourself. Okay. This is an intracellular electrode. You can hold it up, maybe the light, and see how big that tip is. You can hold it. Pass it. Don't stab. If you don't like your partner, you can stab him, I guess. All right. And we'll start going. Here, we can start going back here and we'll come around. All right. So that's an intracellular electrode. That's a little glass capillary pulled on a puller. And the tip of that is only about a micron in diameter. Only about a micron in diameter. Because you don't want it too big to damage the cell membrane, right? You just want it to go across the cell membrane. So that's how people measure membrane potentials in cells without damaging. What's the advantage of this? You can understand that single cell, right? Let's go back, for example, and talk about the cockroach, which you're going to be reporting from, too. This is kind of a misconception. There's many sensory neurons here. There's really hundreds of them that go into this ganglion, and there's lots of neurons that travel in this connector. We can cut this nerve, and you can put a suction electrode over that nerve, and you can record the electrical activity down there. But what are you doing? You're recording from many neurons, hundreds of neurons, potentially, right? So you don't really understand what a single neuron's doing. And so, Maddie, right,
yeah,
is going to explain to you a suction electrode. Come on, Maddie, we can all get this good hand. Just like Vanna White, we don't. Come on.
Yeah,
you could see that. You have to get used to presenting, right? So, Maddie and Jeffrey and Christina are in the other class, the neurophys class, and we just started using suction electrodes in the class.
So there's a wire that, well, first you take a
glass
pipette, and then you break it, and then we also took plastic tubing, or we will, and you melt it, and then you stretch it, and then you put a wire through the glass pipette down. That goes through the plastic mm-hmm. tube, right? And then you also wrap a wire, I don't know where it went, yeah, this wire, around the plastic tubing. And you stick this into, like, we use a dish with saline. And then you, what's the thing that goes on?
The syringe.
And then you get some saline up into, I think you have to usually go up to here.
in the glass pipette, and then you can you suck up the nerve into the end of the plastic tubing.
Perfect.
And then this goes to the, I can't remember what it's
amplifier.
Called. The amplifier.
So what she just said is we're recording then the potential difference from that wire on the inside to the wire on the outside. And that's all we do. And the nerve is in between. And it's a tight fit. You get a better signal, right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Maddie. And so you get the idea of a suction electrode. That electrode only costs like 5 cents to make. We just make them. You can buy them from a supplier for about $50 each. But it's kind of all right, so we make this. So you get an idea of a suction electrode, test question, can record from a nerve many neurons at once, but you don't understand what an individual cell's really doing. But an intracellular electrode, you then get the idea of how that single cell is working, right? And then you can understand that single cell. Now, both have advantages and disadvantages, right? How many cells, like we said, are there's hundreds of them in here. So if you study intracellular one by one by one by one, you're going to get gray hair and lose it like me. And then, you know, you get somewhere. So maybe a suction electrode can tell you better of the circuit in some aspects, or get a handle of what's going on a little bit easier.
Okay. All right, so quickly here,
let's go to this. So how is it that we get this resting membrane potential? Why is this cell maybe minus 80 or minus 70 or minus 20? Remember, all of your cells in your body have different resting membrane potentials. Even in your nervous system, not every neuron has the same resting membrane potential. So that's kind of interesting. And then what makes them, you know, fire an action potential, right? And to do this, the early workers, the gods in the field, Katz, Hodgkin, Huxley, A.B. Hill, back in the 1950s, used a squid axon to do this. And they changed those solutions on the inside, changed the solutions on the outside, and found out which ions were most important for the shapes of these kind of responses that you can record in a squid axon for an action potential. Nowadays, what we can do to cells also is inject like positive current, like number 3, and we get number 3. And if we inject more current into the cell, we can depolarize the cell enough to open up those voltage-gated sodium channels, and boom, you get an action potential, right? And if you go in the negative potential, you might even get a negative response. So people have done this to cells to try to understand how they work. And then you change the ions, and you find out, does it still work the same way? Just, I don't want you to memorize anything here, but just the idea that you have many different types of ion channels. This is just a few of them. You have some that are voltage-gated sodium channels. We talked about the big channels up there, like potassium. Voltage-gated calcium channels. Some of them are so weird. Look at this one. Calcium-dependent potassium channel. So it's a potassium channel. When calcium comes inside the nerve, it then activates the potassium channel. So it's one after the other, right? So it depends on the calcium coming in, and then activate the potassium channel. So those are kind of weird. And they have special properties in how our cells work. But just want you to get the idea that there's many different types of channels, some of them very unique in the way they work. And people have worked out different drugs that work and block these particular channels. Cadmium, these cadmium batteries, you know, you throw them away in the waste, or you throw them in the lake, if you're on a lake, right, you throw them out in the lake, very bad for the fish and the other animals. Because cadmium comes out, and cadmium can block calcium channels. And again, that's why it kills you if you are a kid, eats a battery, it's a problem, because it could be a cadmium battery. If it passes, it's okay, but if it happens to dissolve, that cadmium can come out, and they're going to die from the cadmium. Poison. All right, TTX, you probably heard of TTX, the pufferfish, right? Tetrodotoxin. Crazy chefs that prepare pufferfish, right, in Japan. They actually are supposed to taste the meat that they eat from the pufferfish and get that little tingling feeling. And they're supposed to do it because they don't want their patrons to die, because they won't come back and spend their money. So the chefs are supposed to, like, taste it. And people like that little tingling feeling. What it does is it blocks the sodium channels, so you've actually numbed your ability to feel and taste, and that supposedly is worth paying a lot of money for some odd reason. All right, and so that TTX is very interesting because it blocks that sodium channel. What's the important part about this is that these kind of blockers that people describe, they then could use them as experimentally to understand how nerves work and understand these types of different channels that are present in the nervous system. And then, you know, how do they work? Like, why does the pufferfish kill its prey, for example? And then why doesn't it die from eating that prey that has TTX in it? Interesting thought, right?
Okay, so things to think about. So if we have a membrane, we have ion channels. It's easily described as a circuit, like with a wire, a resistor, and the membrane itself has a capacitor. So if you forgot all your physics, you purge it all. And some people have really loved this in the experiment class we had. So resistors act like ion channels, because if it's closed, it's high resistance. If it's open, it's low resistance, right? And that also means it's a variable resistor, right? Because it can be closed, it can be open. Leak channels are generally open all the time. So if you see a circuit with an arrow across the resistor, that means it's a variable resistor. So really, this should have like an arrow across it. That means it can open or close. It can change its resistance. The membrane, the phospholipid heads, negative charge, but these are also negative charge up here too, right? The phospho groups on the phospholipid. So it kind of confuses students sometimes to think, why is this positive charge out here? Because I thought these phosphate groups were negative charge. They are negative charge. But in general, what we describe as the cell being negative on the inside with respect to the outside, and we draw this with negative charges on the inside, very positive charges lining the membrane. Now, inside the cell, let's say this is inside the cell, the cytosol inside the cell, you actually have electroneutrality. This potential difference only occurs right across the membrane. Okay? So it's not like the whole cell inside, all that cytoplasm is negative. It's not negative. It's just across the membrane where you measure this potential difference. So to describe this, this is a capacitor, and that's a resistor in the membrane. So people try to understand then how these cells work by putting it in diagrams that you could then work with. Explain. I'm going to grab this in case your staff department. Did everybody get through those? Is there another one floating around somewhere?
Or is that two of us? Two of them. Okay. Usually you find out that they break off and they fall on your leg and find it later.
But anyways, okay, so how do these channels work and what makes ions go across? So this is the main factor that we want to think about. So if you had in your chemistry lab, like analytical chemistry, you might do this experiment. You might put two electrodes in a bath. You might have the bath with what's called a frit. It allows certain ions to go across. So in this case, we have a higher concentration of potassium chloride here than here. So what's going to happen? It wants to diffuse over here, right? And keep forward. But what if we put a charge across it? What if we put a plus charge on one side and a negative charge on the other? What's going to happen over time? If we put a plus charge over here, chloride wants to stay here, right? If this is a negative, then potassium wants to come over here. So then, we've made a difference in the concentration gradient, right? In these two places, and we separated this, diffused this, broke this apart, this van der Waal force is not covalent, right? And so, not only the concentration gradient, but the electrical gradient makes a difference. So we have concentration gradient, and EMF is the electro force that's across this membrane. So we have to think of these two things. And how can we describe it? We can describe it by this wonderful equation called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Taft equation, or the Nernst equation, initially. So let's draw this. So let's think about this. Let's do it for potassium. You can do it for any ions. Let's just do potassium first. So the Nernst came up with this, and it's really based on the gas laws. So if you purge your chemistry again, go back, save the book, get it back off of Amazon where you sold it. And you can look at this, and so RT ZF log minus, oops, let's do this, LN, the natural log, outside over inside, concentration of potassium. Okay, so O is outside, I is inside. Okay, inside the cells. So what does this equation, this Nernst equation, represent? It tells you if you have a concentration gradient of potassium across that membrane, you're going to generate an electrical difference. Right? That's all this says. And you know this is happening, right? Because if you have more ions on one side than the other, you've got a difference, right, in the electrical gradient. So it's a little bit hard to work with this in this LN. So if you do experiments, it's kind of easier to convert this. And what are these terms here? R is a gas constant. T is temperature in Kelvin, right? Remember all this stuff, right? Kelvin, absolute temperature. F is Faraday's constant.
and Z is the ionic charge. Okay, so gas constant, T, Faraday's constant, Z. So if we have constant, and we did all our experiments at one temperature, and Faraday's a constant, that means all this is constant, right? So those are, you know, constant if we keep the experiment constant at temperature. LN we can convert to log base 10, right? And it's a little bit easier to work this out. Out over N. Okay, let's convert this, and I always forget these numbers, so I wrote it down. Okay, well, let's think about what temperature we might do. If we're at 18 degrees centigrade, and you put that in for Kelvin and worked it all out that they torture you in chemistry class with, this will come out, this whole thing will come out to 0.058, okay? If you worked at, like, body temperature, maybe 38 degrees centigrade or some experimental temperature like that, this comes out to be 0.61, okay? And then you have log base, this thing, yeah, okay, out over. Well, let's think about potassium. And this is negative. Out here, negative charge. So let's think about potassium. We said it's higher on the inside or outside?
Inside.
Inside. Let's think about a general value, 120. 120 on the inside. And outside, let's say about 10. So anybody got their calculator that can quickly do this on their iPhone? 10 over 120 in log. Just to keep you awake. You're faster at the fingers than I am on my phone. What happens if you do 10 divided by 20 and log? What did we get? Anybody?
Negative 1.08.
Is that right? Is that what did you already times it by?
Oh, I forgot to times it.
0.58? Well, basically just 1, right? Let's just say 1. It's pretty close to 1, right? But is it negative or just 1? It's 1, right? The log of that is 1?
Okay. It has
to be negative. Okay.
It's less,
less. Yeah, so now it's... Oh, yeah, that's right. So it's negative. So we got negative...
Times a negative.
Times a negative. Is that really positive?
Yes. Because you've got a negative at the beginning of the equation, so you've got
a
negative.
Yes, I screwed up something.
Maybe this is... Well, now it's...
Yes, now it's negative, right? Now it's negative. Sorry, I forgot. Okay, so now it's negative. So we had negative, let's say negative 0.58. So what this means is that the potential will be negative 0.058. And if we worked out the units to all this, this would be in volts, or if we could convert this to millivolts, this would be negative 58 millivolts. All right. So if we had this concentration gradient, then we get a negative like 58 millivolts. Okay? So that's kind of cool. So what that tells you, at that concentration gradient, you have this value, and that value gives you your generally your resting membrane potential for cells. So if we had a membrane potential here, and maybe it's like, let's say, you know, close to minus 60, right? And for your external concentration of potassium, if we raise the potassium outside, what happens to your resting membrane potential? If you raise this number out here, this goes up, what happens to this value with this log? It then becomes more, less negative, more positive. So you depolarize the cell. The point we're making here is that this potassium leak that's across the membrane really drives the resting membrane potential. Now, why would the cell maybe not be exactly at the equilibrium potential for potassium?
Other ions,
like sodium. So now if we put the sodium in here and do this for sodium ion, we'll have a different value. All right, so let's do this. So you can actually plot these values, like E potassium. And let's just pretend this is the value here, like minus 58, okay? And E sodium, if we did this for sodium with the concentrations higher on the outside than the inside, let's say this might be plus 35 millivolts. All right, and this is minus 58 millivolts. And your resting membrane potential might be here at minus 50. So your RP, resting membrane potential, might be at minus 50. It's not at minus 58 because there's some sodium
that's also leaking, and it tends to take it away from the equilibrium potential for the potassium ion. So you have to think of both ions. So it's kind of confusing just to do this with Nernst equation for one ion at a time, right? Because it's one ion at a time. And it doesn't tell you about how permeable the cell is to these ions. So these guys, these gods in the field, came up with another equation called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, or GKH. And what this does is it works out the permeability for these ions, permeability of potassium plus the permeability of sodium. That's what P is for. Okay, plus whatever you want to do it for, like calcium, for example, or other ions. Okay, it could be chloride, it could be lots of different things. Right? And you just keep on going on and on and on and on. So you could work out all the different ions and then find out what the equilibrium potential is for that membrane. So this is kind of interesting because this tells you more than the Nernst equation. This tells you if the membrane's permeable or not. And this is where they really worked out what the values are for the membrane potential based on multiple ions and their permeability. And this was all done in the squid axon. And so this is really quite neat, because then you could tell more about the membrane potentials and which ions are important. And they did this by changing the concentrations on the inside of a squid axon, right? Told you it's like a tube, and changing it in the bath, and they worked all this out. Bernard Katz worked out the shape of the action potential, remember? So resting membrane potential goes to a particular level, like threshold, right? Opens up voltage-gated sodium channels. Boom, action potential. And what do we usually see in the textbooks? This hyperpolarization, right? Anything below the resting membrane, hyperpolarization. Anything above the resting membrane, depolarization, right? So here we are in action potential. Voltage-gated sodium channels open up. Well, why does it go up? Well, look where the E-sodium is. This is the equilibrium potential for sodium. This is the driving gradient for that sodium because you have that concentration gradient. So when you open up channels, the membrane wants to go to the equilibrium potential for that. That's why you have the resting membrane potential close to the equilibrium potential for potassium, because the leak channels, potassium channels, are open, and it's going to that equilibrium for potassium. If you open up sodium channels, you go to the equilibrium potential for sodium. So you're going up. So let's say this is 0 millivolts here. You pass the zero, but why does the action potential not go to plus 35? Why is it only going up so far? Maybe up to like plus 10 in this case. Why doesn't it go to the plus 35? If the... Exactly. And so there's multiple things that are happening here. Actually, two good things for test questions. Okay. One, in your action potentials in your nerve, when these sodium channels, that your voltage-gated sodium channels, open up, boom, a lot of sodium is going to go into the cell. Because why? Sodium's high on the outside, the cell is negative. Both factors bring sodium into the cell, right? The negative plus the concentration gradient. Y'all good? Okay. All right, so that drives it into the cell. You depolarize, you're going to eat sodium, but guess what happens to the sodium channel after it opens? It opens, and it goes through continuous. It's like that acetylcholine receptor, like you said. It inactivates. It goes through what's called this inactivation state. So it closes. It closes, and it can't open again. It can't open again until what? Until the membrane comes back down to rest and it lasts for some time. So the cell can't be activated again. It's inactivated by these inactive sodium channels. And another thing that happens, so this is due to sodium channel, voltage-gated sodium channel inactivation. Okay? Activation. And what else happens is you have another threshold here. Now you have a voltage-gated potassium channels that are sensitive to this voltage, and they open up. Okay? So they open up. Now, what's going to happen if you open up potassium channels while you're close to rest? If you're close to rest, RP, how much driving gradient do you have here from E potassium to the resting membrane potential? Very little. Only 8 millivolts, right? So there's only 8 millivolt gradient. So if you open up a whole bunch of potassium channels right here, all you're going to do is just bring the membrane back down to the E potassium.
but look at this. This is kind of neat. If you're now way up here and you open up voltage-gated potassium channels, and say you're up at, you know, like plus 5, what's the driving gradient now? Plus 5, that's 5, plus 58, right, to the equilibrium. So now you have, you know, something very high, a much higher driving gradient for potassium to do what? Go out of the cell. If you take a positive charge of potassium to go out of the cell, potassium positive out of the cell, what's going to happen to the cell membrane potential? It's going to go more negative. And then, if this is why it's another misconception, a lot of neurons in your body do not have hyperpolarizations like this. But the squid axon does. And so they keep showing this in textbooks over and over and over again. But a lot of neurons do not have a hyperpolarization. Just in case you, you know, see those in textbooks, you wonder, where is hyperpolarization? A lot of cells don't have it. But the squid does, and that was the standard, so they keep showing this. And it only can have a hyperpolarization due to what? Only because the E potassium is lower than the resting membrane potential. What if the resting membrane potential was at the same as the E potassium? Just goes to there, right? And you won't have it. So that's kind of interesting to think about. A lot of cells are like this, too, because it's closer to the E potassium. So there's two reasons why the action potential doesn't reach the E potassium, E sodium. One, sodium channels inactivate. Another, voltage-gated potassium channels inactivate. But why doesn't it just stay, if it did hyperpolarize, let's say, why doesn't it stay hyperpolarized? Sodium, potassium, ATPase, but also, what happens here?
The potassium channels deactivate.
Yes, what opened the potassium channels to start with? The voltage way up here. Are we at this voltage anymore when we're down here? No. And these have a slow inactivation, if you will, and really, in the squid axon, we kind of only talk about sodium and potassium like this, but really there's like 5 different types of potassium channels in the squid axon. Some open very fast, some open a little slower, and some have more inactivation than others. But generally, it's because the potassium channel is no longer open because we're not at that voltage that opened them, and the sodium-potassium pump is working to keep it going. If you poison the pump, what happens to your resting membrane potential? You poison your sodium-potassium pump. What's going to happen to your resting membrane potential in your heart, your neurons, your muscles? It's going to go up. It's going to go to 0, right? No more potential across there. You can't maintain it anymore. You can't maintain an ionic gradient. And do people ever die from this kind of thing where the sodium-potassium pump's not working? Yes. How does this happen? Cyanide is one good example. How does cyanide kill you? Bad stuff, right? Cyanide can actually do multiple things. But one of the main things it can do is to block the mitochondrial function. So it blocks the mitochondrial function, and if you can't make ATP, then what happens? You can't keep the pump going. So if you can't keep the pump going, cells start to depolarize, and they go to 0. And then if you can't keep your nervous system going, can't breathe, then you die of asphyxiation, right? So that's a big factor. So that's a problem. If you don't get oxygen to the cells, right? That's a big problem too, right? So carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin about 210 times stronger than oxygen, displaces the oxygen. To make ATP, remember all that stuff that you remember? Glycolysis, TCA cycle, electron transport chain. TCA and electron transport chain needs oxygen, right? So if you don't have oxygen, you only have glycolysis. How many ATP do you make in glycolysis? How many total ATP do you make in glycolysis? Trick question for Alan Fizz students. Total ATP in glycolysis? It's a trick question on standardized exams sometimes. Versus net ATP. Total ATP is 4. Net ATP is 2. Okay, remember that for test questions, right? So net ATP is 2 ATPs. So it's not very many, compared to about 38, 36, or 34 if you can use oxygen. So you're not going to make enough ATP to keep driving the pump, so you depolarize and go up to here, okay? So those are problems with this. Let's say, I don't know, how much more time do I have? Am I over yet? We're just going to work pieces. How many?
2 minutes.
I got another 40 slots. We'll just get through this part and then go through. Okay. And I didn't get the synaptic transmission, but you can read about PowerPoint. So if we raise potassium outside, what happens to your membrane potential? It depolarizes. So is it bad to have high potassium in your body? Bad news, right? Does anybody, some of your healthcare professionals are interested in that? Do you remember what your potassium concentrations are in your body, in your blood? And why is it so important? Why is it so important? It's sad, right? If you depolarize your heart, gone. Depolarize your nervous system, gone. It's all about that potassium level. And what regulates your potassium level in your body?
Kidneys.
Kidneys. If your kidneys aren't working, say you're going into kidney failure, and you're losing too much potassium, you're hypopotassium. What if you can't excrete well and you have a higher potassium level? Hyperpotassium. So hyperkalemia, these are the Latin names, hyperkalemia or hypokalemia, high or low. And it's a very narrow window. Anybody remember that window? 3.5 to 5. Or in some textbooks they'll actually use 4.5. If you go higher than that, you're high potassium. And you could end up with arrhythmia problems. And if you're looking at EKG, you always see the, you know, P, Q, R, S, and then the little T wave, right? You get a peaked T wave, you're probably hyperkalemic. Kind of interesting that you could tell that just by looking at EKG. How does a veterinarian, how do they used to put down, if you live on a farm, for example, how do veterinarians, they don't, you know, use some anesthetic a long time ago, they just use a cheap way to kill the horse or the dog or the cow. Besides shooting at the head. I grew up on a farm in Texas, and we slaughtered our cattle all the time. But anyways, but what they might have done, and the cheap way to do it, is, and actually this happened to healthcare professionals. There was a group up in Michigan, I believe, where a nurse was working in a retirement home. She killed like 5 different patients in there and thought they were helping them by knocking them out because they were on IVs, and what did they do? All they did was inject potassium chloride, like 3 molar potassium chloride, into the IV, and the person dies. Just like that, right? And this is the way they used to put down animals. So potassium chloride is really very dangerous. If it goes too high on you, your heart's not working, your brain's not working, and you're going to die from it. So it's so important you go to the ER, right? And what are they going to do? To drop your potassium level down if it's too high. Can they go in there and just remove potassium? Anybody have an idea? Anybody work, rotate in the hospital settings or something like that? They can put something up your behind, and it's called cacalate. It's a resin that will absorb potassium. So they put it up your behind because your large intestine is very vascular. And this will pull the potassium out of your blood into the resin, the cacalate, and then you get rid of it, and they put up more, and they pull your potassium level down to save your life. Who cares about what goes on the ground? You're going to live through it, right? Because you need to get that potassium level down as fast as you can to survive. So this is kind of interesting to think about. This is why people on like dialysis are very worried about their potassium levels. All right, so we kind of went through tangents and lots of tangents, and I didn't get through everything I was going to talk about. But you can kind of look through there. There's your beautiful squid and all that good stuff. And we didn't get to any of that. And we didn't get to that. So maybe, I don't know, Dr. Jones, maybe, is going to talk about, are you going to talk about synaptic transmission later?
I don't know if we'll have synaptic transmission. We'll definitely talk about brain coding and
stuff like that.
Seal spikes for brain.
But they have this PowerPoint on your class website, and you have to go in the podcast. You can look through this. It's kind of fun. This is what we teach in 350, Bio350, AMLFiz, Festival of Transport. More Nobel Prizes were awarded through this. Sorry, I went through all my tangents and couldn't get to the 90 slides. You can always email me with questions if you like. Glad to answer questions. I only had 89 slides.